Hello, this is John Mueller from 800 CEO Read. Today I am talking with Hugh McLeod, author of Ignore Everybody and 39 Other Keys to Creativity, which is going to be released by Portfolio on June 11th. Hugh, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, John. Glad to be here.
Sure, sure. So the book, Ignore Everybody, deals a lot with the idea of the struggling artist. What do you think are the fundamental things that keep people, artist or not, struggling?
I didn't hear that. Excuse me?
Sure. The book deals a lot with the idea of a struggling artist.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think are the fundamental things that keep people, whether they're artists or not, struggling?
Lack of money and recognition. No, there's an old saying that art is always in conflict with its own value. You're kind of creating something out of nothing, and it's worth nothing until somebody else says it's worth something. But at the same time, it's still, you know, art's very labor intensive to make. So, and I think, I also think there's no guarantee of value from the end of it, because when you're kind of going out there on a limb, there are all your kind of strange, weird ideas. You have no idea whether what you're going to do is going to be successful or not, but at the same time, you can't really turn off the tap. If you got the thing going, it's really hard just not to do it, give it up, and become an ice cream salesman or whatever.
Right.
So having this big creative monkey around your neck and trying to function like a normal human being is very hard as well. So you're kind of damned if you do and damned if you don't. So I think that's the hard thing.
Right.
That's a big struggle, but
I think your book addresses that really well too. And I'll ask some more questions really pertinent to that later on. But that was one of the things that really impressed me about the book is addressing that. Very few people have addressed that. It seems like either things are you go in one direction or you go in another direction. But it rides a fine line. But before we get into all that, I want to go kind of back a ways to when you started this whole idea of drawing on the backs of business cards. So as people get the books or if they read your blog, they'll discover that that's one of your things is you make these drawings.
Sure.
You started doing them on the backs of cards. And what I thought was interesting is you started doing that back in New York while sitting at a bar. Now, I think for some people that this situation might turn into a dead end in and of itself. But you kind of took it out of that. What made your situation different? How did you get out of that kind of dead end route and take it somewhere else?
The short answer is I never stopped doing it. I think most people would have stopped after a couple dozen drawings. Last time I checked, and that was a couple years ago, I had over 5,000 drawings. Mm-hmm. You know, and the thing is, I never expected my work to be commercially successful. I never expected it to be particularly recognized. So. And I had a pretty good job at the time. I liked my job. I liked my social scene. I liked living in New York. And I didn't want to give that up to become a struggling artist. So I just assumed I was never going to get rewarded for it. So it didn't really matter to me whether or not other people liked it. And so that allowed me to carry on having fun with it rather than worrying about what am I going to do with it afterwards. Because I think, you know, if you spent, you know, 5 years of your life writing a, you know, 2,000-page novel or a 800-page novel or whatever, you don't want to sit, unless you're crazy, you don't want it sitting under your bed. You want to get it out there. You want to show the publishers and editors, you know.
Right.
And I never assumed I'd get that far. I assumed that even if I got that far, everyone would tell me to change it or make it more palatable or make it more less adult or make it more child-friendly or more whatever, and I didn't want to go down that road, so I just kind of said, well, I'm just going to do it until I get sick of it. And also remember, in New York, you know, you have these tiny little apartments,
mm-hmm.
and you're out a lot, so I didn't really have a format. You know, I didn't have a painting studio. I didn't have, like, big, you know, canvas and oils. I loved walking around the city going to coffee shops or bars or museums or whatever, and just if I had an idea, I'd just sit down on a park bench or whatever and start drawing it. So it was very, and then after I stopped living in New York, I was moving around a lot. So you know, I like having a, you know, I can keep, you know, 4 or 5 years worth of work in one shoebox, which
right.
is just quite good. So
yeah,
I like that aspect of it.
How did you get it? Did the blog, your blog, gabingvoid.com, did that come out of an idea to take those cards into a different form, or how did that happen?
I just think everybody, you know, this was like 2001. Everybody had a website, and, you know, I started building a website, and every time I wanted changes, I had to pay my webmaster, and then along comes the blog format, which is easy and cheap and actually free.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't have a lot of money, and so, you know, I like the blog format just because it was cheap and easy, and so
right.
I just started doing it that way.
Kind of like the cards.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, life's complicated enough, and that was it. No looking back.
Yeah.
And then I, you know, after I posted cartoons for the first 2 years only.
Okay.
And then I started writing the blog as well, and I started writing about marketing and stuff and all that stuff. And then I started writing about creativity, and that formed the basis of Ignore Everybody.
Okay. You commented on the content of the cards a little bit there in your answer.
Yeah.
And I want to address that because that's something, I mean, honestly, when I first picked up the book and was reading through it, I mean, admittedly, that was the first time that I became familiar with your work, and
okay.
it really struck me. I thought, wow, this is incredible. Like, I mean, I really dug what you were saying, but it was also a shock to me that this was a business book, or at least it was published by a business book publisher, and I thought, wow, you know, how are people going to react to this? And I guess I'd like to hear your thoughts on how you think, not how you think the business culture is going to react, but how you see, you know, I think people are attracted to these. Obviously, you have a following. You have people that
yeah.
read your blog regularly. What do you think that reflects about the business culture today?
Well, you know, business culture is generally pretty conservative, and I think it's always been conservative, and I think it always will be conservative. I told someone the other day, you know, it took me a couple of months to write the book, but it took me 4 years to find the right publisher for it.
Huh.
well, you know, I could have taken some of the more controversial cartoons out and made it a bit more, shall we say, corporate friendly, but I said, you know, I'm only going to, you know, this might be my only book, so I'm going to just put all the cartoons in it that mean a lot to me. I don't care if it affects sales or not. Those are all, most of the cartoons are there. There's about 100 cartoons in the book. I'd say 80 of them were pretty seminal cartoons for me. They meant a lot to me. And if they had the F word in it, too bad. It still meant a lot to me. I was there when I drew it. And I don't really swear that much, but, you know, it's just, you know, you live in New York, everyone talks a lot of potty mouth stuff, and I was kind of writing the way people talked. I certainly wasn't trying to impress some business community. So, and luckily my publisher said, yeah, well, you can put any cartoon in there you want, and because it'll be a more interesting book, I think. If I just made, like, business motivational cartoons, you know, kind of New Yorker Scrub Gilbert cartoons. I don't kind of a wannabe that kind. I don't think it would have been so interesting. You know, I just put the cartoons there that were important to me. And I think, you know, they're important to me for more personal reasons than business reasons. And I think that kind of personal motivation kind of shows up in the work, whether or not you like potty mouth words or not.
Definitely, definitely.
That makes sense, yeah?
It totally makes sense. I think it's important too, in that just a lot of the ideas that you discuss, the cartoons don't necessarily they don't directly support these ideas, but they're ideas in and of themselves. So it
right.
shows that there's some honesty behind it. I'm glad.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm glad
yeah,
the publisher
exactly.
kept it in.
Yeah, I mean I think this was Portfolio was probably the fourth or fifth publisher I talked to, and everybody else I talked to before that kind of wanted me to make the book different, and I said, well, I already pretty much wrote the book on my blog, and I don't want to change it. It just works the way it does, and just leave me alone, or don't waste my time, but, yeah, you know, you show the book to people, I think you have something that's a bit more original than a lot of the business books out there. So, you know, I wanted the book to come from me. I didn't want it to be a business book.
I think it worked.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the title, Ignore Everybody. That kind of implies a sense of isolation. What's important about that?
Well, you have to ignore everybody because when you have a really good idea, no one can tell you whether the idea is any good or not. You know, you have to, only you can decide whether it's worth pursuing, whether it's worth risking everything for. And the advice other people can give you is going to be fairly limited because they don't know you as well as you know yourself. And the other thing, good ideas are fairly are resisted a lot because a good idea will alter the power balance in a relationship. And as I'm fond of saying, I think I said this in the book, I said, you know, good ideas have lonely childhoods. There's just a point when you just have, it's just you, God, and the idea, and there's only so much input that other people can tell you because, you know, they already have their own idea to worry about. They're not worried about your idea. So there's a certain kind of loneliness to a good idea at first, and then hopefully when you develop the idea a bit more proof of concept, then people step up to graduate you or whatever. I mean, I remember when I first started doing those business card cartoons, everybody thought I was crazy. Why are you doing it that way? Shouldn't you be doing something a bit more commercial or whatever? Shouldn't you be sending your stuff out to T-shirt makers and newspapers? I didn't want to do that. I wanted to make cartoons that were my own, not somebody else's. So I had a pretty good job at the time and things were going pretty well, and I didn't mind working. I could do that. I think if you have an idea, the first thing you look for is approval from other people. I don't think the chances of the idea being any good, I think, are going to be a lot lower.
Okay, I want to go back to what I referred to earlier. One of the really interesting things that I found about your book is the sex and cash theory, which people can look into that on their own. But I guess my question for you now would be, you know, what's wrong with the idea of pursuing your passion full time? You have a lot to say about that.
Oh yeah, well I think you're pursuing your passion full time, but no matter, you know, every creative life is governed by two things, or the sexy part of the job, and then the part of the job that pays the bills. And whether we're talking about, you know, you waiting tables and then working a novel when you're off work, there's a schism there. And then, but even if you're a successful artist full time, you still have parts of your job which are going to be compromises. And I cited John Travolta. Like, one year he'll be in a very hip, ultra hip, cool flick called Pulp Fiction, and then the next year he'll be in another movie called Broken Arrow, which is this forgettable spy thriller that he just did for the money. And this kind of managing your need for creative sovereignty and managing your need for making a living, there's always going to be conflict in that. It's never going to go away. And what I said in the book was that people who can understand that dichotomy, who can understand that tension and just live with it and accept it, they're more likely to be successful than the person who just expects all the compromises to never be there and it just expects to one day magically wake up and doing what you're passionate full time. Because, you know, even if you're doing what you're passionate about full time, there's still a lot of crap you have to deal with every day, you know, dealing with vendors and suppliers and agents and all these people. They're always asking you for stuff, you know. And especially if you get really successful, all of a sudden you have, you know, a big operation to keep on the road, then the compromises get even more horrendous. You know, this myth where you have an artist who makes no compromises and just, you know, do what they're passionate about and don't pay attention to anybody else, those people, you know, it's a myth. I don't think those people actually exist. So, I think my message with that chapter was, hey, just grow up and understand.
Right.
Tension, you know.
Yeah.
And I guess I was lucky because, you know, I was a pretty late bloomer in all this. So I've been through the mill a few times. So by the time my stuff got above the radar, I could pretty manage that tension. So I'm lucky to been a late bloomer.
Yeah. Well, that was one of my other questions too. I think it seems like there's a lot of people who have big dreams of becoming artists or innovators, but then they end up settling for business. And you seem to kind of started in business and now are moving towards art. Is that kind of
I didn't start in business. I was drawing cartoons in college for the local alternative paper. It didn't pay me very well, and this is when I was in my early 20s. And I never saw myself making a living doing it, so I said, well, I don't want to wait, I was living in this college town, Austin, Texas, and I didn't want to end up like, all the other waiters and bartenders in town, getting tattoos and calling myself an artist. And so I wanted a job. And so I said, well, I'm pretty good at cartoons, so what could I, what job could I get that uses the same part of the brain that actually pays? And that was advertising, so I went and got myself a job as a creative in a large advertising agency in Chicago, and I worked in the advertising business for 15 years, but, I always kept a sketchbook with me, and I would, after work, I'd go to the cafe or bar or whatever and draw, and I kept that going for many years, and then the business card format came around because one day I turned up at the bar and I forgot my sketchbook, and I still wanted to draw, so I had some business cards on me. I just started drawing the back of those, and then I found it quite like the format, so... And like I said, I just never stopped. I don't know why I didn't stop. I just didn't. So, I think if you're a creative person, I think especially, you're young, in your 20s or whatever, it's good to go out there and get a real job because that adds a dimension to your experience. You get a hell of an education if you have to go work in an office that does interesting things, as opposed to, work in a coffee shop and paint in the evenings and call yourself an artist. So that's not a particularly interesting life. I think you should go out and have adventures and swim with the big fish. I think the more big fish you can swim with, the better it will inform your art over the long term. But, of course, you might find yourself, getting married and liking expensive things, and that will probably make it harder to be an artist or whatever, but... Hey, you grow up, you make choices. And that's why there's so few artists making a decent living just doing art. It's because it's really bloody hard to go from point A to point B.
Right, right.
It's much easier just to get a job in an office and get somebody pregnant. And buy a house in the suburbs. And I just never got there. I never did that. So.
Yeah.
I just waited long enough for the world to catch up with what I was doing.
Sure. As if the book and the cartoons and your blog weren't enough, talk about how you got involved in the wine business.
Oh yeah, the wine. But yeah, I'm a head of marketing for a small wine company. We import South African wine into the United States. I wrote this thing about marketing called the Hugh Train Manifesto, which is just my little rant on marketing. And the big insight about that was that people are driven to find meaning in their lives, and if your product can help people better articulate their own narrative, their own personal narrative, then you've got to start a very successful brand. Anyways, this guy who owns Stormhook, Jason, he understood that, marketing was changing. This was like in the early 2000s, that the Internet had changed the language of marketing. So he started reading a lot of marketing books. I started reading a lot of these books. He read The Tipping Point, and then he came across a guy called Seth Godin, who actually has the same publisher as me. He started really getting into Seth Godin. And then he found out Seth Godin had a blog, and Seth Godin knows my work. He's a friend of mine, and one day Seth linked to me, and so he found out about my blog, and then he found out the Hugh Train Manifesto, and he just called me up and said, "Hey, why don't you come down and have dinner? Let's talk. Let's see if we can work together." And we worked together pretty well, and we were the first wine company to really use blogs heavily. Web 2.0, and it sold a lot of wine because at the time, back in 2004, 2005, it was so out there that we got a lot of attention from the trade press, and you know, and pretty soon the whole industry was talking about us, and it worked pretty, that worked out pretty well, and I'm still involved with Stormhook, and it's, you know, it's just one more feather to your, you know, one more string in your bow. I think I've been one of those people who likes to do different things every day, or else I get bored. I can't just sit down and draw and draw every day. Day in, day out, it would drive me nuts. So I like to go out there and have new adventures. So that's one of them.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's a totally different thing, but it still feels like you when I read the that blog. I mean, it still feels the voice is the same, the ideas are similar.
Yeah, we're just shifting.
Yeah.
Well, we're just shifting bottles of wine. I mean, the thing about wine is wine isn't that interesting. What's interesting is. How people socialize around it, you know, how people hang out together and, you know, talk about the meaning of life and, you know, have sex and all that kind of stuff, you know.
Right.
You know, eat, you know, break bread with each other. That stuff's all
right.
All marvelous stuff. And I think what we did is try to tap into that energy rather than just go, here's why you should buy our wine. It's cheap, it's good, it's best quality or whatever.
Right.
You know, we didn't really talk about the wine so much. We talked about the people who are drinking it. And to be fair, I think the people who drink it are far more interested than the people who make it. So
yeah.
So that, and nobody else was doing it at the time, so.
Well, and still it's not totally common.
No. But the thing is there's so much wine out there. I mean, Italy alone has 50,000 wine brands. 50,000, okay. I mean, you're talking about, you go into a supermarket, there are only 3,000 brands in a supermarket. Italy has, whatever that is, you know, almost 10 times as much wine brands alone. There's a lot of wine out there, a lot, you know, so you have to do something kind of interesting and different, or else no one's going to notice you.
Well, and let's be honest, when you see all those wines on the shelves, what do you either buy something that you had before or that the label looks cool, you know?
Yeah, exactly. You don't buy some boring looking wine with some generic label on it. Life's too short,
right,
you know?
Right.
I mean, yeah, there's a kind of fantasy that, you know, the Wine Spectator and, you know, oh, that has a 96 on the Parker scale, but
right.
Those people who care, they're like 2% of the market. Most wine is bought by, you know, elementary school teachers who are making spaghetti for their boyfriend that night. They just want a nice bottle of red to go with the spaghetti.
Right.
You know, all that kind of, you know, most people don't spend over $10 on a bottle of wine. The people who collect $100 bottles, yeah, they do exist, but that's the tiny minority. You know, I mean, when's the last time you spent more than $5,000 on a work of art? No, I mean, seriously, when was the last time?
The last time I spent more than that?
Yeah.
Never.
Exactly.
Right.
That's what most people do. They spend, you know, a couple hundred bucks on a work of art.
Mm-hmm.
They don't spend $20 million on a piece of Damien Hirst. You know?
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And wine's the same way. You know, yeah. It's the upper end of the market is just a tiny part of the market. And I've never been too much of a wine snob, so that side of the market never interested me. So it made it easier for me to not have a lot of baggage with that, because I think a lot of wine marketers get caught up with the upper end of the market, and even though they're marketing the lower end of the market. So, but, you know,
well, I guess my final question is, I mean, you're involved in a lot of stuff.
Sure.
You do kind of keep it simple in terms of being consistent, but what's next? What can we expect to see in the future?
Oh, well, I'm making a lot of art right now, prints.
Right.
And that's going pretty well. I don't know how long it's going to take me to turn into a business as big as I want it to be. Right now, it's about a tenth the size I want it to be. And I have no idea how long it's going to take me to get the other 90%. I want to continue marketing Stormhook, the wine in America, particularly Texas. And then I want to find time to paint, you know, those kind of paintings that are never going to sell. and then we'll see how this book does. Maybe I'll have another book in me. I'll write that. And
are you considering that?
Am I considering that? Oh, I don't know. I have an idea for a book. I'm not sure it's good enough. I mean, you know, it's like after Harper Lee finished writing To Kill a Mockingbird, she never wrote another book just because she knew she was never going to write another book that good. I can relate to that feeling. I think I want to continue. The one thing I'm always going to try to do is draw a new cartoon. You know, do something that's going to be... I'm always going to want to draw another cartoon. That's the one thing I know I'm going to do. And whether I can turn it into a business or money or whatever, I might be able to do that. But that feeling's never going to go away. I'm always going to want to do just one more time at bat, you know what I'm saying? And try to keep that interesting. And then all the other business projects will just kind of fall in its wake, you know, follow in its wake. So, the hard part is to keep on drawing because it's much easier just to turn on the TV and drink beer.
Yeah, it is. Right.
So it's especially after you've already paid your dues to kind of stay motivated. It's easier just to slide.
but it still. I mean, it goes into your whole idea of you know doing stuff that you like to do anyway. It's not like you're making yourself do this stuff. You know.
Yeah. And I think I always say this to creatives that, you know, once you get successful as a creative, the world suddenly expects you to do twice as much you're actually capable of producing realistically. So you spend your time just playing perpetual catch-up, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I need 40 more cartoons by Tuesday. Ah, pressure.
Right.
And that's the hard part of being successful as a creative. It's just all of a sudden the need to produce just grows exponentially.
Right.
Whereas, you know, if you're just undiscovered, you can just kind of sit in your hovel and just type away at your own pace and nobody cares.
Right.
But having all these people care all of a sudden is very, it's nice, but I dare say it takes some getting used to.
Yeah. I encourage everyone when the book is out to pick it up. Definitely. I mean, honestly, Hugh, it really had a profound effect on me. I read it in one sitting. It really struck me.
Thank you. It comes out on Thursday, so about 3 days' time. Thursday, the 11th of June.
Yep. So everyone listening to this, if you haven't seen it yet, grab a copy and be sure to visit the blog. I've stayed up with your blog too, and it's great to have the book and have this precise info in your hand, but it's great to kind of keep the ideas going by checking.
The trick I learned from Seth Godin, you know, having a book and a blog is a damn good, they have kind of complementary skill sets.
Pretty nice, yeah.
And that keeps it interesting.
Yeah.
All right, John, well, thank you for all the lovely questions.
Thank you, Hugh.
All right.
Thanks for the listeners, and I'll sign off here. Thank
okay,
you.
Okay, great.
Bye-bye.
Ciao.